From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The following item needs almost no introduction. According to Lycos, it was the most searched item in the history of the Internet, eclipsing even the violence of September 11th. The earth-shattering event to which I refer is the Super Bowl halftime show exposure of Janet Jackson's right breast. FCC Chairman Michael Powell called it a, quote, classless, crass, and deplorable stunt, and he pledged to open an immediate investigation into the halftime show shenanigans.
But what power can the FCC really wield? Well, it can levy fines, and pending legislation would increase them tenfold to $275,000. Also, it used to be that a show that contained obscenity would be fined once. Now each incident within a show carries that penalty. In the case of MTV and CBS's Super Bowl show, the crotch-grabbing and bumping and grinding alone could add up to quite a tidy sum for CBS. Alicia Mundy is a fellow at the New America Foundation and our resident expert on all things FCC. She says CBS and parent company Viacom, those fines might still be chump change, but the ultimate cost could be a lot higher.
As you know, CBS lucked out last year when the media ownership limits were raised because it was over the limit of the number of different broadcast stations it could own around the country. And when the number raised to 39%, CBS got kind of a waiver. So right now, CBS needs very much not to tick off anybody in Washington, and Michael Powell and the Federal Communications Commission can make them grovel and can at least have the amusing spectacle of Mel Karmazin of CBS sort of on his knees with a sackcloth and hair shirt and ashes and everything coming to them, and that will probably be worth it.
But let's look at the particulars here. Compared to what is on network television every night of the week, was the halftime show at the Super Bowl really so fundamentally offensive and fundamentally different from the general fare?
The cynic in me would like to point out that it's a presidential election year, and it's family values time, big time. And congressmen who I personally know laugh about going to Hooters are coming out of the woodwork now to talk about the importance of keeping Janet Jackson and everybody else covered up on the air. I mean, you cannot downplay the political significance of this and the timing.
I want to ask you about Michael Powell and what his motives might have been in this very public display of outrage. He, of course, is still wiping egg from his face over the FCC proposed rules, which would have permitted still more media consolidation. And I think was surprised to see intense criticism, but from the right and the Republican Party in Congress. Is any of this an attempt by him to sort of get back on the horse and regain his stature as the sheriff in Media Town?
Yes, indeed. I think basically there was a rush by Michael Powell and Commissioner Kevin Martin, who would like to be the next Michael Powell, to get the microphone first to denounce the indecency that they had just observed. And Michael beat Kevin this time. So, yeah, there's a lot of politicking here. There's grandstanding. This is Powell showing, listen, I know what the issues are. Sure, I took it on the chin over media ownership, but watch me now. I know how to play this game, and I'm going to make obscenity on the airwaves the most important thing since the use of your telephone.
Do you believe that there could be action in Congress to actually begin more regulation of content to prevent such episodes before they ever occur?
Well, they always have to worry about that small problem called the First Amendment, but as a matter of fact, there are going to be two back-to-back hearings next week, the Commerce Committee with John McCain and the other in the House Commerce Committee, where you will see possibly 100 politicians by the time the day is over, fighting with each other to be the first to suggest a better way to get even with CBS and other networks in the future that do something like this. They could very well propose something in Congress to go after the licenses. The network's local stations have licenses that are always up for renewal. And I think you will see a number of those proposals floated next Wednesday. Also, there's another issue at play here. You know, there are no restrictions at all on cable, which is why you can always say the F word on cable. And some of the members of Congress now, in light of this Janet Jackson incident, are talking about what demands they can make on cable to watch its kind also. So I think this thing could get nasty before it gets better.
I want to ask you briefly about the cast of characters. It seems to be changing. Principal oversight for the FCC is at the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, and its chairman, Billy Tozen, has just resigned that position and will be, in all likelihood, replaced by a Texas congressman named Joe Barton. Tell us about Joe Barton and what you expect to hear from him.
Joe Barton is, I believe, a 7-term congressman from Texas. He's fairly conservative, and last week he was already heard complaining about the halftime show and indecency on the air. The people I talked to who are in the telecommunications business said nobody wanted to have to point out that, in fact, the statute says nothing about indecency on the air. It's obscenity on the air, and indecency is sort of what you can get away with. I know that in the past he has complained, at least to some reporters, including me, about too many shows involving gay themes on the air. So we could be in for some pretty amusing hearings coming up.
All right, Alicia. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Our friend Alicia Mundy is a fellow at the New America Foundation. Had it not gone down in the record books as one of the most watched moments in TV history, and TiVo gets some credit for that, Super Bowl halftime 2004 might have been remembered as the focus of another flap over broadcast standards, namely the controversy over an anti-Bush administration ad produced by MoveOn.org and rejected by CBS. The network says its policy is not to air advocacy ads. But scarcely had that tiff died down when another controversial ad started grabbing headlines. This time the sponsor is the U.S. government, and the subject is Medicare.
So how is Medicare changing?
It's the same Medicare you've always counted on, plus more benefits, like prescription drug coverage.
Can I keep my Medicare just how it is?
Yes, you can always keep your same Medicare coverage.
I save on my medicines?
You can save with Medicare drug discount cards this June, and save more with prescription drug coverage in 2006.
So, my Medicare isn't different, it's just more.
Right. And you can learn more. Call 1-800-MEDICARE.
The spot is part of a $12.6 million ad campaign that hit the airwaves this week, and it comes just 2 months after Congress narrowly passed a major overhaul of the Medicare system.
There is nothing in the Medicare television ad that helps our seniors understand the real implications of that bill.
Senator Edward Kennedy, who led the charge against the Medicare legislation, is once again at the forefront of the assault against the new advertising campaign.
Clearly, it's improper and clearly it's outrageous to use Medicare beneficiaries' money for campaign sloganing, and that's what this is all about.
What Kennedy told us, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, of course, doesn't see it that way. Joining me now to discuss the Medicare ad campaign is William Pierce, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at HHS. Bill, thanks for joining me.
Bob, thanks for having me on.
So what are you hoping that viewers will take away from this ad?
Well, it's really very simple. Our objective is what it has been for the last 2 years in the ad campaign we've been running. We've had the 1-800-MEDICARE ad campaign, and that is to provide seniors with a little bit of information, but then to drive them towards our 1-800 number so they can call and get more information. The previous campaign, we knew from our survey, seniors didn't know as much about the Medicare program as they could have known and therefore weren't using the benefit as much as possible.
And it's certainly not unusual for the federal government to advertise to explain the services that are out there. The Internal Revenue Service does it every single year.
Right.
Okay, so let's talk timing. The
Sure.
provisions of this law don't really kick in for 2 years. What is the benefit, if not political advantage, of advertising the changes now?
Actually, one of the benefits kicks in this June, and that's a discount drug card. So this ad mentions the discount drug card. And then there are other benefits which will actually kick in next year in 2005, and those include things like a first-time annual physical for people entering Medicare. This year, you have a change in a program which really hasn't changed much over its 38-year history. So we want to take the time we have to get to as many seniors as we can so they understand or at least know where they can go for more information.
Okay, fair enough. But there are critics on the left and on the right who say that the timing of this ad is not about informing seniors, except to inform them about what the Bush administration has done for you. And they charge that it's a waste of taxpayers' money in order to give President Bush a political advantage in an election year. How plead you?
Interesting that they would say that. Congress also, in addition to passing the Medicare law, gave us money to implement and educate seniors about the new legislation. I think what mostly seeing, certainly from the left, is a very cynical attack that, frankly, is in kind of poor taste. I don't know if they're trying to scare seniors away from this or they're afraid that seniors will find out what this program is about. I'm not quite sure the motivation.
Well, if it's motivated by cynical politics, how would you explain the objections of the National Taxpayers Union, which is a right-wing organization that is itself urging the administration to yank the ads?
Interestingly enough, too, I might mention I spent a year working for the National Taxpayers Union. They have always had a long tradition against, you know, government spend. They were a balanced budget group. So I think their motivation is more simply the fact that we're spending money on the campaign itself. And again, I would argue strongly that the responsible thing to do here is the education of seniors. We owe it to them to tell them what these benefits are and try to get them to call the 1-800 number.
Before I leap to take your remarks at face value, I've got to just mention something that raised my eyebrows.
Sure.
And that is that the ad campaign is being managed, the media buy, by an outfit called National Media.
Mm-hmm.
This is a political advertising firm, which, coincidentally enough, has among its clients President Bush's reelection campaign. Shouldn't I be concerned about that?
No. National Media has been doing the ad buy, and that's all they literally do is buy the media time. And a firm like National Media buys lots of media for lots of clients, therefore they get good discounts. So we're getting a good bang for our buck for the American taxpayer. They've been doing this campaign for 3 years. No one has said a word for the last 2 years about National Media's role. Interestingly enough, also I might point out, Ketchum Communications is the firm which is managing the entire account for us. One of their senior vice presidents, a guy named Chuck Dolan, is on Senator Kerry's finance committee. We haven't heard anybody complaining about that. So, again, this is just cynical politics. I think when people see this ad, they'll see this is as simple, straightforward, a traditional kind of cookie-cutter ad that you can see out there.
All right, Bill. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob. It was a pleasure.
William Pierce is Deputy Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He spoke to us from Washington.
Coming up, the criminal element in cyberspace and why the early coverage of the president's budget didn't add up.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. After President Bush unveiled his proposed national budget last Monday, the online community went into overdrive, offering instant analysis of not just the budget, but the coverage of the budget. Bloggers complained that though the numbers didn't add up, first-rate analysis was noticeably absent from the front pages of many newspapers. They were not alone. New York Times op-ed columnist Paul Krugman is known to take swipes at the Bush administration, but he's also been pretty critical of the press, and he says the coverage of the budget left many readers in the dark.
It's been pretty disappointing. The stuff that everyone who's following this knows, stuff that's not difficult, the effects of making the tax cuts permanent on the long-term deficit, the effects of alternative minimum tax reform, which everybody has known was an urgent issue for years now, all of those things are invisible to someone who isn't working at it professionally.
Well, bloggers, most of whom are not professional economists, seem to have picked up on it right away. One blogger, Brad DeLong, broke down the Washington Post coverage of the budget, and he wrote that the first 10 paragraphs were exactly as the White House media affairs would want them to be, and you didn't get substantive criticism until paragraph 26.
That's right. I mean, that shouldn't be happening. I know, yes, you don't want the news section to read like a partisan attack, but in the very first few paragraphs, you should say something like, this is a budget that raised eyebrows around Washington, or something like that, because it's true. That's the real story, not the boilerplate that came with the official presentation.
But isn't part of this simply the fact that covering budgets is hard?
No. This particular time was completely unforgivable. For one thing, we knew the main content of the budget before it was actually released on Monday. The basic outlines had been released by the White House, so we had all of that. Budget analyses, you don't have to be a budget expert yourself. You can go to think tanks. They all have some partisan agenda, but you can check their work. And any reporter who was at all worthy of his job would have been ready before the budget came out to write an analytical story that got it right.
And how much do you think that standard journalistic practice contributes to what amounts to misleading coverage?
I think it's partly standard journalistic practice. It's partly the, if the president says that the earth is flat, the news story at best says shape of the earth view differ.
Are there any other things that journalists do that sort of work in the president's favor in presenting perhaps a more positive slant on the budget than the numbers would suggest?
I think the point is when you see lines that say things like critics say that the administration's forecast of cutting the deficit in half is unrealistic, they shouldn't be saying that. The newspaper should say the administration's forecast of a deficit of $230 billion in 2009 omits $100 of costs resulting from programs that the administration itself is advocating.
So why do you think that stuff isn't in the stories?
I have multiple explanations, and I don't know which is true. But one thing I know is that it's just very unpleasant to cross these people. I think news organizations and individual journalists find that it's a very harrowing experience to be perceived as not being on the team with the current administration. And I think that they cover themselves by ensuring that there isn't anything to grab hold of, at least on the first page, that will mark them as being enemies.
Newspaper reporters are relying on the idea that maybe a lot of administration officials don't read past the jump?
No, I think that the administration officials don't care what's past the jump, because they know that the general public doesn't really follow it. They care about what's on page one, not on what diligent readers will find in the 26th paragraph.
Now, I've called you knowing full well where you stand on the administration's budget, but I'm asking you to be an analyst here. Do you think it's possible to be objective when it comes to evaluating the budget?
Oh, sure. There's a difference between advocacy and simply describing the facts. So if you say that the improvement that is forecast in the deficit according to the president's budget relies upon Congress not renewing some expiring tax provisions, which the administration has urged Congress to renew, then you're not being partisan in saying that. You're just saying, look, this number here is not the number that would result from the administration's own policies. We are not talking about issues of economic theory here, and we're not talking about issues of political slant. We're actually just talking about arithmetic.
Well, Paul Krugman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul Krugman is an economist at Princeton University and a columnist for the New York Times. The year is still young, but computer hackers are already hard at work, crashing our hard drives and clogging the net with worms and viruses. The latest outbreak, MyDoom, has already wormed its way into 500,000 computers worldwide. Writer Clive Thompson traveled around Europe and cyberspace, talking to the masterminds behind some of the world's worst virtual viruses for an article in this week's New York Times Magazine. And he says that many of them are just what you would imagine. Bored, tech-savvy teens.
Definitely the younger ones, I would say, are very bored. I mean, some of these kids I talk to, they're out in like 600-person towns in the foothills of Austria, and there is nothing to do. I wandered around a little bit with them. I'm like, if I lived out here when I was a teenager, I'd be doing something online.
Find one over 30?
No, they do exist. The ones I talked to were all the ones that are very active in the scene. What tends to happen if you talk to psychologists who have studied virus writers is that they age out. The same way that, you know, if you had a troublesome teenager who was, you know, breaking curfew or experimenting with drugs, they age out of that.
And you describe the scene, and I love your words. You say it's oddly gentlemanly, almost like the amateur societies of Victorian Britain. What did you mean?
Well, what I meant is that, you know, if you go back to Victorian Britain, science was very much an amateur's game. People would get together at the end of the day and they would exchange papers on things in a sort of an attempt to prove what they had to say and to contribute in this very sort of public-minded way to the furthering of knowledge. And these guys work in a very similar fashion. They're motivated, yes, by a desire to sort of be kind of rebels and yes, by boredom, but also because there's this very big community of them, hundreds or even thousands of them, and they all want to impress each other and they all want to see if they can discover a new technique that no one else has discovered. And then they really want to share it with everyone else. They want other people to use it.
But they don't all want to wreak their virus upon the computer world. Some of them do.
Yeah, there are a lot of very weird ethical gray areas in virus writing. The smartest guys know that the cops have it in for them. They know that if they are caught releasing a virus into the wild, is what they call it, then it could be traced back to them and they could. So they don't release them. They stopped doing that a couple years ago, the most talented ones. They'll just put it up on a website. The way they figure is at that point in time, their responsibility is over. If some miscreant, some teenage rebel, or even terrorist you know, decides that they want to use it to actually wreak havoc. That's actually probably how a number of viruses come into circulation, is that these things are left lying around.
And most of these perpetrators, not the inventors, but the people who actually send them into the wild, are called script kids?
Script kiddies. It's a derisive term that comes out of hacker culture, the idea being that a script kiddie is someone who doesn't really know how to program but wants to pretend that they're a fearsome hacker. And so they go around and they find tools or code that is, you know, again, freely available on hackers' websites or on virus writers' websites. And they maybe fiddle with it a little bit. They put their name on it. You know, I am Lord Anarchy or something like that. And they're the ones that set it loose because often they don't really understand the damage you could do, or they just care less about getting caught. There are virus writers that do release their own viruses where the laws are not prosecuted very carefully. The police don't care. So there's guys in Malaysia. There's guys in the Philippines. There's some guys in Russia. They're in the minority, but those are the ones that are probably even a little scarier because they have the means and the will to do it.
You said that 2003 was the year of the worm. What's the difference between a worm and a virus?
Well, a virus is essentially a little program that arrives usually in email, and it only starts doing its dirty business if you click on it. You have to double-click on that attachment in the email. As soon as you do that, it reaches inside your computer, and it adds new commands to the operating system so that, say, the next time your computer starts up, it'll see those commands there. It'll think, well, this is something I ought to do. And maybe something as benign as pop up a little message saying, you know, it's a virus writer's birthday, worship me. Or it could erase your hard drive. Or it could scavenge data and mail it off to the virus writer. A worm is a little bit different because a worm generally can spread without you needing to click on anything. It travels by finding a vulnerability in the computer, sometimes in the operating system, almost like a little hole or a gap, and exploiting that. Worms are a little more dangerous in some respects. Although they don't necessarily always affect your computer, they propagate so quickly because they don't need human assistance. They can brown out the internet, almost like the way that air conditioners, if a lot of them are on at once, can brown out the power grid.
So let's look back at the evolution of these things. You quote somebody in your article that compares the early viruses to Ebola and the more modern ones to AIDS.
When viruses first came around in the late 80s and early 90s, people were interested with doing a bunch of very dangerous things, like erasing hard drives. And what people realized is that those viruses don't always spread very well because they kill off the host. It's like Ebola. Why has Ebola never raged out of control, really? Well, because by the time it infects the entire village, it doesn't have time to spread anywhere else because it kills everyone in 3 days. There's no one left alive to walk to the next village. Same thing with computer viruses. If you destroy someone's hard drive, the virus can't spread anywhere else. The new viruses, the MyDooms or the SoBigs, they're like stealth viruses. They're designed to get on your system and do their dirty business without you ever noticing they're there.
So that is the current wave of deadly virus. You look ahead to even deadlier ones.
Sure. I mean, the fact of the matter is, because there's so much of this computer code out there that's freely available, it's almost like Lego bricks. You know, you could go out there yourself and just take some of this code and complete into a new breed, add a new illicit idea of your own. Criminals, literally organized criminals, are behind some of the big worms of the last year. They take worm technology and they use it to infect your computer with things that are like keyloggers.
And what are those?
Well, a keylogger logs records of every keystroke on your computer. So it can capture all your passwords. If you type in your banking information, it would capture that. Anything in your email. And then it emails it off to an email box for the worm author so they can do identity theft or they can steal your credit card.
What does the average computer user do to protect themselves against viruses and worms?
The first thing they could do is just never click on any attachment that arrives in your email box unless you are already expecting it from someone. I have had virus writers tell me, if people didn't click on these attachments, that would pretty much kill our entire scene.
But some of those attachments come from people you know, or appear to come from people you know, because they're being sent through other people's mailboxes.
That's right. Unless your friend has told you, I'm going to send you something in a few minutes, don't click on it.
Nobody's going to do that.
You see, the virus writers are students of human frailties. All of them, basically, to one would say, sadly, our discipline is contingent upon the idiocy of the average person. So fundamentally, what you're left with is, you know, really make strong examples of anyone you can catch spreading these things, try and scare people off. I actually think it does work, because if you look at the U.S., there is much less activity amongst virus writing scenes because they're afraid of getting busted. As more countries get serious about this, it could potentially start to diminish the amount of viruses we see around. I doubt it could ever be gotten rid of entirely because there's a very large global supply of bored teenagers, basically, and that's not going anywhere.
Clive, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Clive Thompson wrote about the virus underground in this week's New York Times Magazine.
Last month, Lithuania became the latest nation to ratify the Council of Europe Convention on Cybercrime. With Albania, Estonia, Hungary, and Croatia, that makes five, which renders the treaty open for any nation in the world to sign. President Bush calls it, quote, the only international treaty to address the problems of computer-related crime and electronic evidence gathering. In November, the president sent the treaty for ratification, and it has been sitting there ever since. But groups like the Electronic Privacy Information Center and the American Civil Liberties Union say this treaty is bad, bad, bad for personal freedoms. Barry Steinhardt, the director of the Technology and Liberty Program at the ACLU, says this treaty isn't what this country needs to combat child pornography, hackers, and viruses.
The treaty goes well beyond those things that most of us would think of as computer crimes, like hacking or cracking into somebody else's computer system. It can be as simple as a mugger who's walking around with a Palm Pilot that happens to have internet capabilities. That suddenly becomes a cybercrime under this treaty.
Is that an exaggeration?
No, it's not an exaggeration at all. Literally, a mugger who commits a crime who used his Palm Pilot to send a short email in connection with that crime is eligible for investigation and for all the draconian powers that are available in the cybercrime treaty.
Tell me why this treaty was drafted in such broad terms and what provisions particularly alarm you.
Well, the treaty was very broad, in part because the United States insisted that it be very broad. Despite the fact that it's called the Council of Europe Treaty, it's actually a treaty that was largely driven by the U.S. government. Perhaps the worst provisions of this bill are those provisions that allow for countries to insist that we help them in prosecuting or investigating a crime, even when the act that is being investigated is not a crime in the country that's being asked to do the investigation. So the Chinese government could come to us and say, we have this dissident. They won't say that. They say that we have this criminal, and we want your internet service providers to give us all his records that happen to be in the United States. And we are essentially forbidden from inquiring into why it is they want to investigate him. And we are forbidden even from requiring that the act that he's being investigated for be a crime in the United States.
Now, there is a specific prohibition on political crime in the language of the treaty.
The problem is that the decision about whether this is a political crime is going to be made by the U.S. Justice Department. And I don't think that most Americans at this point trust John Ashcroft to be deciding what's a political crime and what is truly a criminal matter that deserves investigation.
Let's just put aside for a moment the awkward question of the United States assisting repressive foreign governments in draconian police investigations. Let's talk more about the protection of U.S. citizens. If not provisions such as we find in this treaty, what law enforcement tools are available to U.S. investigators in preventing the kinds of crimes that this treaty is at least ostensibly designed to combat?
Well, we, of course, in the U.S. already have laws that prevent cracking into someone's system, the spread of the Doom virus. All those things are already crimes in the United States, and we usually have, in fact, bilateral or multilateral treaties that will allow it. The cybercrime treaty is simply not necessary for that. It's a question at this point of whether or not we're going to have sufficient resources and will to deal with those problems and whether the business community can be marshaled to protect itself.
As I understand the treaty, it permits Carnivore, the technology that allows the Justice Department or the FBI to go directly into an internet service provider and essentially monitor location. It would make that a legitimate tool of policing, but it's not currently legal in the United States for the government to employ the Carnivore technology.
The USA Patriot Act does permit Carnivore for what is known as a pen register or trap and trace device. That's basically looking for addressing information. But it doesn't permit it for the content of communications, what we're actually saying. The Cybercrime Treaty actually requires nations to have Carnivore-like capacity.
And what happens when provisions of treaties that the United States is a signatory to turn out to be unconstitutional or are declared unconstitutional in U.S. courts?
Well, that's going to be the $64,000 question here. First of all, the courts would only deal with it once the treaty is ratified. But secondly, they'll only deal with it case by case, where there are real people before them. Take some time before a case gets up to the federal court. Beyond that, of course, in many cases, the victims here are simply not about their victimization. These are powers that are used secretly. Often the businesses that are required to provide information are actually forbidden by federal law from disclosing that these powers have been used. So in many cases, the individuals involved will simply never know, won't be in a position to challenge them.
Well, Barry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Barry Steinhardt is director of the Technology and Liberty Program at the American Civil Liberties Union in New York City.
The internet is really, really great.
For porn.
I got a fast connection so I don't have to wait.
For porn.
What? There's always some new site.
For porn.
I browse all day and night.
For porn.
It's like I'm surfing at the speed of
Coming up, Ed Sullivan's really biggest shoe and the reverberations from America's many echo chambers.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Every once in a while, we examine words or phrases that have been percolating in the media, and the phrase that's been bubbling up lately is echo chamber. It used to mean a room with hard reflective walls, a speaker, and a mic, but now it's mostly a metaphor. Cass Sunstein is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School and author of Republic.com. He says the phrase can be applied to a wide array of cultural reverberations.
Sometimes what's meant by echo chamber isn't something completely new. It's like a rumor mill. And the idea is that if you have an idea or a claim about a fact that's repeated over and over again, then it will start to assume reality. But sometimes, and it might be a little more interesting, the echo chamber is narrower to some part of the citizenry. Say liberals will all hear one thing echoing, and conservatives will hear another thing echoing, and they'll be very different things. So people will, in a way, live in different social realities just because they hear such different claims about the facts.
And there are some media watchers who call this manifestation of the echo chamber incestuous amplification.
Yeah, the term incestuous amplification is often a military term, and it's used there as a warning against military leaders who keep talking to each other as if they're in a family, and then they don't watch out for things that can go wrong. And so incestuous amplification is just a recipe for disaster. That military idea has a lot of parallels for completely non-military groups like companies like Enron, where there wasn't much dissent. People were just echoing one another's optimism in a way that led to disaster. And in terms of sometimes government behavior, when there's incestuous amplification for a domestic policy that goes sour and might not have if people who lived outside the echo chamber had had a chance to speak to the people who live in it.
Let's talk about the echo chambers that you specialize in. These are the chambers that exist both small and large in cyberspace.
Yeah, the internet has many great advantages from the standpoint of democracy because people can expand their horizons. But one thing that's happened is that many people use the internet to narrow themselves so that they end up speaking mostly to people who already agree with them. So one just fact about the operation of the internet is you get these dean supporters, for example, speaking most of the time to fellow dean supporters. And the same can happen for Bush supporters who hear only what other Bush supporters say about the Democrat or about France. And the internet really facilitates a situation in which people are in a way living in echo chambers that they themselves have created.
And this phenomenon you've applied a new term to called cyber cascade. Does that relate to incestuous amplification, only it's on the web?
Yeah. Cyber cascades are specifically a web phenomenon in which one fact or something that's supposed to be a fact is stated to another person who then tells maybe another dozen people who then tell maybe another 10,000 others, and pretty soon people all over the world are hearing and potentially believing something that just isn't so.
At the risk of being obvious, state for the record what you think the long-term impact of the proliferation of these echo chambers would be.
The greatest danger of the echo chambers is unjustified extremism. So it's a well-known fact that if you get a group of people who tend to think something, after they talk to each other, they end up thinking a more extreme version of what they thought before. And the danger of that is you can make a situation where mutual understanding is difficult and people don't appreciate, but instead demonize those who disagree with them. And that's an ongoing threat to our democracy.
So beware the echo chamber.
Yeah. If it turns out that we're talking mostly to people we agree with, something's been wrong. And there's a kind of obligation for citizens to leave their echo chambers at least some of the time and seek out dissenting opinions.
Okay. Cass Sunstein, thank you very much.
Thanks for the questions. Great. Thanks a lot.
Cass Sunstein is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School and author of Republic.com.
With so many different channels of communication, Americans have fewer and fewer experiences we share as a nation. The halftime show last Sunday was one, but it can't compare to what happened February 9th, 40 years ago, when the Beatles first appeared live on the Ed Sullivan Show. One of the top-rated broadcasts of all time, that show was seen by 73 million Americans, but in 1964, that amounted to nearly 40% of the U.S. population. OTM's Paul Ingalls takes us back.
Most people remember the Beatles' Ed Sullivan performance as their first on American television. Well, it wasn't. Sullivan made a deal with Beatles manager Brian Epstein for three CBS appearances in February 1964, but Ed got scooped by his NBC rival Jack Parr on January 3rd.
The Beatles are an extraordinary act in England. I think they're the biggest thing in England in 25 years.
Jack Parr, he and Sullivan have been having a feud for years.
Bruce Spicer is author of a new book on American Beatlemania called The Beatles Are Coming.
His idea was to see if he could con the BBC and get footage of the Beatles performing and air that on his program prior to Ed Sullivan showing the Beatles on his show, and that is precisely what he did.
These guys have these crazy hairdos, and when they wiggle their head and the hair goes, the girls go out of their minds.
Parr showed newsreel footage of Beatles concert, then film of a complete performance by the band. He announced that the Beatles would soon play live on Ed Sullivan's show, but the plug did not appease Sullivan. Bruce Spicer.
Sullivan was absolutely livid. In his negotiations with Parr, he was assured that he would be getting the first and exclusive appearance of the Beatles on American television. And he contacted his European talent coordinator, Peter Prichard, and told him to cancel the Beatles. Fortunately, a day or two later, Sullivan realized it would be a mistake to cancel the Beatles, and he called up Peter Prichard and canceled the cancellation.
Advance publicity about the Beatles only got better. The Beatles, whose records had flopped in the U.S. in 1963, suddenly topped the charts. And by the time they landed in New York February 7th, they were dominating top 40 radio nationwide and charming the press, who kept asking, why the name Beatles?
John thought of the name Beatles, and he'll tell you about it now. it means Beatles, doesn't it? You know, that's just a name. You know, like shoe.
The shoes. You see, we could have been called the Shoes, for all you know.
Commercials for the Really Big Shoe, as Sullivan often called his own program. Sorry, couldn't resist. The Beatles took no chances with their sound. They helped the technicians mark the audio console with chalk so they'd remember precisely how the music and vocals would be mixed. Swamped with 50,000 ticket requests, CBS only had about 1,500 to give away. Half for the evening's live show, and half for an afternoon dress rehearsal and taping of a Beatles segment to be broadcast 2 weeks later.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Leslie Samuels Healy was a 14-year-old New Yorker in 1964, and one of her friends scored them afternoon tickets.
If you were there, you felt the electricity, the whole energy of the Beatles. Again, it was like I'd ever lived through.
When I say that something, I wanna hold your hand.
When Sullivan was going into all the commercials, The fans booed. The audience booed. They didn't want to hear about Pillsbury or Anison. They wanted music.
Let's take a moment right now for an interesting idea from Pillsbury.
But there was more booing. I think they had to cut out when other people were being introduced.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, a very fine novelty act, Wells and the Four Fays. So let's bring them on with a reunion.
It was typical Sullivan. The Beatles, plus magicians, acrobats, vaudeville-style comedians, a few big stars of the day, all destined to become answers to Beatles trivia questions. After the afternoon taping, the theater was emptied and the sound technicians took a dinner break. A new audience came in for the live broadcast, and when the techs returned, they found that all the chalk marks on their console, indicating the perfect Beatles mix, had been erased by the cleaning crew.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
The CBS sound team had to wing it through one of the most important live music broadcasts of all time.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always do.
Also winging it were the cameramen, who, screaming, couldn't hear any of the director's instructions. The crying, bouncing, squealing fans caught on camera were the envy of Petrie, who had to watch it on TV. Elise Kosserin, a college student in Ohio at the time, saw the show on a communal TV set in the lounge of her dorm.
We're down there in our robes and slippers watching, and not necessarily screaming, but kind of squealing inside. I can remember a very different reaction by some of the girls, actually. They like, why are you going downstairs? What's so important about the Beatles? But there were those of us who felt that it was something that we needed to see, because they were so much a part of everything that was happening then.
In the days that followed, the ratings for the broadcast were announced. 73 million viewers, the largest TV audience ever. Sullivan historian Jerry Bowles.
I think whatever reservations the American media may have had, they were easily overcome, and particularly when the newspaper saw those ratings, those 73 million people, they knew that somebody out there was paying attention.
Tonight, live from Miami Beach, the Ed Sullivan Show.
The next week, another 70 million or so tuned in to see the Beatles in a scruffier Sullivan Show, broadcast from a ballroom at Miami's Deauville Hotel. Everything about this remote broadcast felt loose. The Beatles chatted up the audience, the temporary stage creaked, and the sound mix was a bit off. But author Bruce Spicer says there were still great moments.
One of the really wonderful performances was on This Boy. You had all three of the Beatles sharing one vocal microphone, and it seemed to be a very intimate moment.
Oh, and this boy could be happy just to love you. But oh my, that boy won't be happy.
After Miami, the Beatles never performed live for Sullivan again. They furnished him and other shows with taped performances and films that many see as precursors to music videos. But nothing matched the energy of that first live Beatles show on February 9th. It's still one of the most requested videotapes at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. Arthur Smith is curator of a Beatles in America exhibit there.
It augured a new age of popular culture in which it became sort of an international youth culture. There's something fairy tale-like or mythic about the Beatles, and to be able to watch that actually happening, unfolding before your eyes, is an incredible experience.
Four Sullivan shows featuring the Beatles are out now in a DVD set. And 40 years after being in the Sullivan audience, Leslie Samuels Healy decided to make a personal Beatles pilgrimage. She got tickets to David Letterman's February 9th show in the Ed Sullivan Theater. She wanted to sit, she saw the Beatles live. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
I have that Ed Sullivan DVD set, and to see the Beatles again within the context of that show is to appreciate, again, the power of anarchy. Tucked within that tidy hour of crooners, comics, and puppeteers, the pandemonium wrought by the mere appearance of the Beatles felt like revolution.
Even Ed seemed uncertain the Fab Four would play by the rules. But America had loose cannons of its own, and one of them even appeared on a Sullivan show with the Beatles, where he sang his own hit song.
Hey, do the mouse, yeah.
Talk about youth culture. Part Pee Wee Herman, part Krusty the Clown, Soupy Sales was the loosest of cannons, playing a succession of local and national kid shows from Detroit to L.A. to New York. And we loved him. Partly because he was nuts, with a cast of hyperactive hand puppets manned by someone's hairy forearm, partly because of the roughly 19,000 pies he hurled over the decades. And partly because of this ultimate bit of mischief on New Year's Day, 1965. He asked us to go into Daddy's wallet and, quote, get those little green pieces of paper with pictures of George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Lincoln, and Jefferson on them, send them to me, and I'll send you a postcard from Puerto Rico. He was suspended for a week, and then to our relief, returned, whereupon he was immediately smacked by a pie. This week, I finally asked him why on earth he brought up those little green pieces of paper.
Oh, that was really, something, the green pieces of paper. It was one of those things that happened spur of the moment. I could do what I wanted to do, and I did it. It was a wild show. Highly unpredictable. They tried censorship a few times, but it was never very effective because there was never any problem with what I was doing. Nothing really they could nail me on.
It put me in mind of Janet and Justin, now generating a torrent of hot water for CBS, the NFL, the sponsors, Congress, and the FCC. Janet and Justin got nailed. Soupy says they asked for it. It was calculated, and it was for thus.
I think the same old argument. I don't think it's any different.
TV has always been a reflection of America in a funhouse mirror. Sometimes we just don't like what we see. We can pretend to be shocked at Jackson's glittering nipple. We can call it a rude awakening. But the reality is, for anyone who spends any amount of time slack-jawed in front of what has long been called the boob tube, it's just one more pie in the face.
Pachalafika, Pachalafika, they whisper it all over Turkey. Pachalafika, Pachalafika, it sounds so romantic and perky. Oh, I know that phrase will make me thrill always, for it reminds me of you, my sweet. Just the mention of that tender word of love gives my heart a jerkish, Turkish beat. And it's there we'll stay till the very day we find out what pachalafika means. We find out what pachalafika means.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Bull and Derek John. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dee Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. And the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.